Welcome. This is the Mite Action Advocacy Podcast Series, and we are going to get started in just a minute. We are really excited about this topic today. The call will be recorded, so please keep that in mind when you are asking questions. We do have a page on our website that is devoted to this podcast. If you would like to navigate there right now, you will actually find our slides and our other materials as well. That's on the main page. You can see it's the very first post on the front. And if you have any questions about navigating to that spot, just feel free to email me. This is Christine Cox. I'm the Director of Outreach and Advocacy for Mite Action. And we are going to get started in just a minute. So under most recent news, you'll see incapacity planning and guardianship. If you click on that, you'll be able to access all of the documents that we'll be going through today. There's a PDF, and then there is a set of slides. So we'll get started in just a minute. We're going to give folks until 12 o'clock to join. Is there anybody on the line who would like to introduce themselves?
Hello.
Hi, who's this?
Irina Campbell.
Hi, Irina. It's so good to hear your voice. This is Christine Cox, as I mentioned. Are you able to find the slides and everything?
Well, I was going to write a letter, and so I just saved that. Now I'm coming. I have to get logged on to Google Chrome to get to that.
Well, we'll remind you how to get there, so I'll say it a couple of times for sure. So definitely... definitely email me if you have any questions at all, but we will get started in just a minute. I think you're really going to get a lot out of this, Irina. It's great to have.
No, I really need this very badly because I'm alone.
No, definitely.
I don't have a caregiver. I do have a housekeeper. She speaks Spanish. She has no legal jurisdiction over me whatsoever. I finally found a person at a church who says that they are willing to go to the emergency room with me because I had a terrible time in emergency rooms not getting appropriate care and winding up in tears with the doctor not following my emergency protocol letter and just sending me out of the emergency room with pain medicine I cannot take that's contraindicated for me.
Yeah.
See your doctor on Monday, which is useless for me. So this is a very important session in my case.
Definitely. I think this advanced planning is going to be really, really good for you, and you can get everything in order and feel really good about that.
Yeah, in theory, I tried to do that several times. I have not been able to find a guardian willing to take my case.
Maybe we can talk about that in the question and answer session.
Yeah, really need some help there.
I
started 5 years ago, more than 5 years ago, when my husband became really incapacitated. He's been dead 5 years now. And at that time, I had everything ready for one of these geriatric care management companies, including a key to my house, instructions where to find my medicine inside my house. A lot of information, you know, who to contact regarding my financial issues, etc. And signed a contract. They wanted $500 for that initial thing. They sent me the bill. I laid the bill on top of my calendar, intending to pay it within the next couple of days. And then I got a letter or a phone call, I'd forgotten what, terminating.
So, Irina, I want to remind you, this is going to be a recorded line.
Yes.
We're going to want to make sure you and I can definitely talk about some of this offline. But
could we please? Because this is really, this is, I can only put the word hideous on this for the last 10 years.
Let's get your questions answered during this session for sure. For those of you who are just joining, welcome. This is Mito Action's Advocacy Podcast Series. We are very excited today to have Annette Hines and Mark Worthington joining us. We're going to get started in just a couple of minutes. If you want to go ahead and navigate to our main Facebook page right now, you can go ahead and find the slides and the documents that we'll be going through today. business might help you as you are listening to Annette and to Mark. The link to the main page about this podcast is going to be under most recent news. It's entitled Incapacity Planning and Guardianship. And if you click on that, you will see there will be two separate spaces for the documents. First is under attachments, right above the picture of the net. That's going to be the first document that we go through. And then there's a link in the join us box that says view the slides. That will be the slide presentation that Annette will take us through. And we're going to go ahead and start recording in just a minute. We'll see if we've got a few other people joining us. Keep in mind that at the very end of this presentation, we will be able to have questions and answers. I will remind you, please, to keep those questions and answers general, because we are going to archive this in iTunes, and we want to make sure that your personal details don't get captured in that. So please, right now, I'm going to actually be going ahead and muting everybody in just a minute, but once we get to the question and answer period, we will go ahead and unmute the line so that you can ask whatever questions you might have. Okay, well, I see that it is 12 o'clock, so I'm going to go ahead and get started with the recording right now. You might hear a series of beeps, but just hold the line and we'll go ahead and get started.
The conference is now in silence mode.
Welcome, everyone. This is Mito Action's Advocacy Podcast Series. The date today is Wednesday, March 23rd, 2016. And I am delighted to have Mark Worthington and Annette Hines from the Special Needs Law Group of Massachusetts joining us to talk about incapacity planning and guardianship. Annette and Mark, are you with us?
We are.
Wonderful. Well, we are very much looking forward to your presentation today. This is an extremely important topic and one that you don't want to leave to the last minute. Advanced planning, as with most things, is really the way to go. I want to direct everybody to our documents that we're going to be talking through today. If you go to our main webpage at vitalaction.org, you will see under recent news, incapacity planning and guardianship. If you click on that, you will be able to see the two documents that we'll be going through today. The first is listed as an attachment. It's in a PDF form. That will be right above the picture of Annette Hines. And then the second document that Annette is actually going to take us through is in the join us box. If you click view the slides, that will take you to a slide presentation. So welcome everyone. I'm so glad that you are joining us. I would like to introduce Annette and Mark. Annette Hines is the founder of the Special Needs Law Group of Massachusetts. She also is the mother of two daughters, one of whom passed away from mitochondrial disease in November of 2013. So she knows our community very, very well and is very sensitive to the issues that mito patients face. We also are fortunate to have Mark Worthington with us, who is a senior partner at Special Needs Law Group of Massachusetts. Both Annette and Mark have been named super lawyers, which is a great designation throughout the country. Are extremely well-versed in this area. They practice in it every day, so we are extraordinarily fortunate to have Annette and Mark with us today. So let me go ahead and turn it over to, I think, Mark, you were going to speak first about incapacity planning.
Yep.
Wonderful. Well, go ahead and let's go ahead and get started.
Okay. So we've got a lot of material to go through. There's about a 6-page outline, which is fairly detailed. I'm not going to talk about every piece of it, but I want to try to kind of link it all together and talk about a couple of things in particular there. One thing I wanted to point out mostly is that I'm primarily here because Annette is suffering from some degree of laryngitis today, and I'm here to save her voice. Otherwise, you could just listen to her for the entire time that you're here. So, why incapacity documents at all? In most cases, incapacity documents for you will
help avoid guardianships and conservatorships, which are court-appointed positions. A guardian is a court-appointed person who will take control of certain aspects and perhaps all aspects of your personal life, personal care decisions, where you live, what the doctors will and won't do to you. Conservators are the people who are court-appointed, people who would take control of your finances. And these things are, they're to the extent that they apply, they're plenary. They remove autonomy from you and shift it to another person. That other person may be somebody you know and trust. It might not be. The particular places where these won't really help avoid guardianships and conservatorships, and I'm out on the outline at 1A, if you're following along, where, you know, if let's say you were incompetent, you needed help, you had executed some of these documents, but you were objecting vehemently, you had become paranoid, you're objecting to their use and so forth like that, then that's effectively a revocation of them, and medical professionals and others would be obliged to go to court to obtain a guardianship or conservatorship or get the documents enforced. Another great use of these is that you yourself, in most states, if not all states, can nominate for the court who, if the court decided, yes, in fact, you do need a guardian or you do need a conservator, to nominate who you would want to serve in those roles. And in most states, that wish of yours, absent something like the person you name being a convicted felon or in jail or something like that, will almost certainly prevail. Another great use of these documents is that you can use them to appoint and nominate guardians and conservators for minor and incapacitated children, even adult children in some states. And, probably in most states, but also in some states, you can even have this take effect if you, say, if you simply become incapacitated, whereas historically, this is only, you can only nominate, people to serve as guardians or conservators for minor children and so forth when you had died. So what are the incapacity documents? Well, one that we're really not going to talk about today because it's an entire discussion all on its own is a revocable living trust to the extent that it's funded. Now, funded means...
Mark, if I could just interrupt.
Yeah, go right ahead.
Earlier in the series, which would have been in 2015, we did have a podcast on general estate planning, so we did go over the use of trust to a certain extent. So... wanted to mention that for those of you who've listened to my podcast before, you might remember that.
Yes, and if anybody would like to review that podcast, it is accessible under Advocacy Podcast Series. In that menu path, you can find a link to all of their podcasts. So, thanks very much.
All right. Oh, I bet that there's a lot of good stuff about revocable trust there, how they can help if they are funded. So they're not just tools for planning for when you die or for probate avoidance or whatever, but they can also be great tools for marshaling assets. Banks and financial institutions, insurance companies are much more respectful of successor trustees' authorities than they typically are, for example, of somebody who you've named as an agent under a power of attorney. That's one of their primary selling points. Then we have durable powers of attorney, healthcare proxies, HIPAA authorizations, advanced directives of various kinds, and appointment and nomination of guardians and conservators. So I'm going to try to whip through these because I've got about, I don't have an awful lot of time left already. So the first thing about these to talk about is what kind of legal capacity do you need to even execute these documents? And you may be aware, those of you who have any experience about guardianships at all with other people, or perhaps even in your life, maybe you've had some experience for yourself, there's different levels of legal capacity for different kinds of purposes, and a person can be competent to do one thing and not to do another, to make one kind of decision and not another. So the capacity to execute a will, for example, is among the lowest that is known under the law. It's a very low legal standard. The capacity to execute a healthcare proxy is actually fairly low. It's lower than the capacity to make the medical decisions that a healthcare agent needs to make. So, for example, I know it's not uncommon, for example, for the director, the psychiatrist who's the director of a geriatric mental health facility, unit in a hospital, to have a patient sign a healthcare proxy, be appropriately witnessed. By the way, healthcare proxy is often called a durable power of attorney for healthcare in other states. It's a healthcare proxy in Massachusetts. Execute the proxy, and on the spot, the doctor invokes it, and now the healthcare agent who's named in that proxy, who was just executed a minute ago, is now making the decisions for the person who signed it. The highest standard is probably contractual, and durable powers of attorney kind of live in that area. So a durable power of attorney in some states has an extraordinarily high standard of capacity in order to execute. In most states, I think it's probably just the capacity to more or less understand that the principal is giving concurrent authority, not plenary authority, like in the case of a guardianship or conservatorship, giving authority to another to handle various non-medical affairs. And if there's a gifting power, that the agent under the power of attorney can actually give away the principal's assets. I'm not sure that we need to spend a lot of time, I'm on number four now, on the revocation of authority of an agent under a power of attorney or a healthcare proxy. Pretty much under the power of attorney, healthcare proxy, on the indication of authority, I don't know that we need to spend a lot of time on it, but on a power of attorney and a healthcare proxy, those are generally going to be good immediately. You can have a durable power of attorney that's only springs into effect when you're incapacitated. In general, those are fairly ineffective because the financial community simply won't honor them without a court order. So in general, you want a durable power of attorney to be good immediately, even though that's kind of counterintuitive because you don't really need anybody to use it until you're incapacitated. A healthcare proxy is by law in Massachusetts, and I believe in most states, always a springing power, so-called. In other words, the authority of the agent that you name is only invoked upon determination by an attending physician in writing in your medical records that you lack the capacity to make or communicate healthcare decisions. And different states have different tweaks and variations on that, but that's the general policy. Revocation of these documents oral is generally sufficient, but really you should try to have it, if you're going to revoke these, have it in writing, delivered to the agent and delivered to each person or institution that you believe might have a copy on file. That can be a little bit difficult if the document has gotten fairly widespread. Now, sometimes this comes into an issue here where at 5E I talk about an incompetent person who's attempting to revoke. So this is the point that I was talking about at the very beginning of the talk, where we have a person who's executed a healthcare proxy when they were competent. Later, let's say they sink into dementia. With dementia, not infrequently comes paranoia. Good intentioned people are trying to do the right thing, and they want the individual to take some kind of medication, perhaps an antipsychotic. I don't know. I'm not a medical professional. That helps them have a happier, better life, etc. And the person, however, is paranoid and won't take the medicine. And this only increases their paranoia and spirals out of control. So they're there. They're saying, I don't want that medicine. I don't want you to tell me what to do, etc. This is an effective revocation of the healthcare proxy. To fix that, we either need a court declaration that the person is incompetent to revoke the healthcare proxy, or we need a guardianship. Powers of attorney. Powers of attorney are very powerful. They have a lot of issues. I just want to run through a few of them. They're basically statutory documents, meaning they are creatures of statutes, just like healthcare proxies. They didn't just arise out of court-made law like trust law did, wills, and so forth. It provides concurrent authority with your agent is that's named. So unlike a guardianship, unlike a conservatorship, and unlike a healthcare proxy, when the healthcare proxy is invoked, when you grant someone authority as your agent under a power of attorney, and it's not a springing power, which as I told you is a very useful document, when you give that power, they have concurrent authority. Now, they're not supposed to use it in any way that they know or should know is against what you would want done. But third parties are supposed to rely upon the document and rely upon the agent. So there is concern sometimes, well, gee, what if the agent abuses the power? Fact is, studies are showing, the ones that I know of, that other offices are abused. You know, guardianships can be abused and so forth, and even non-offices, so for example, children who are joint tenants, or even just children taking, you know, grandma to the bank, grandma's, you know, say suffering from some level of dementia or just kind of going downhill in life, you get a grandchild maybe in there, taking grandma to the bank, and saying, grandma, go take out $500, and doing that every day with grandma. So the kid doesn't even have to have, the grandchild doesn't even have to have any authority whatsoever and still financially abuse the elder. So the truth is, powers of attorney, although they sound kind of scary, in practice really aren't any more scary than anything else out there in my view. The real issue with powers of attorney is that they're frequently resisted by financial institutions. So that when somebody comes along a few years after a power of attorney has been executed, wants, needs to use the power of attorney, banks, insurance companies, brokerage houses are very reluctant to honor them. It depends on the brokerage house. Sometimes they're accepted right away, sometimes they're not. It's very, very variable out there as to what you run into. Here at our office, we've had, just in the last year, we've had very, very hard settlements with some of the local banks. And yet we've also had very easy acceptability at a major, major national brokerage house, also in an office just down the street. You never know what you're going to run into. A good power of attorney should have, and just like a good healthcare proxy in my view, should have a good list, at least 3 deep if you can find that many people, 3 deep of successors to serve. You can have multiple concurrent agents, and they file a 6D now, with either mutual or joint several authority to act, but in general, it's probably best to just have one serve at a time, so you have your agent, and then if they can't serve, you have an alternate, and if that one can't serve, you have an alternate to that one. These are documents of enumerated powers. They need to be, in my view, lengthy. A 1 or 2 page document is probably not up to snuff. If the document just says, effectively, anything I can do, my agent can do, it's not going to stand you in good stead at crunch time. There are different methods to try to get increase the acceptability of these documents with financial institutions when the time comes. One is to see, E1 now, one is to see if the financial institution will basically keep it on file. I call it registering, that's not an official term. Another is to see if they won't do that, if sufficient authority or actions can be taken by phone or web access and then have that password available to a very trusted agent. And if they're not that trusted, why did you name them? Sometimes institutions have their own forms, but they may or may not be adequate to the task. The enumerated powers, there's a lot of different ones that they need to have. Probably one of the most sensitive, or probably, not probably, the most sensitive power is the power to make gifts. But it's also probably the most necessary when it comes to things like public benefits. This is something that you really need to talk with your attorney about. Should you have a gifting power, or so how broad? Should there be checks and balances? The more complicated you make it, the more difficult it may be to actually get anything done that's needed when the time comes. If you want your agent to be able to do things like buy yourself to tack on another side of a transaction with you, or even make gifts to themselves, like if your agent is your child, you need to make sure that the document explicitly provides that. That's under self-dealing at J. There's plenty of other powers that need to be in there, but these are not one-off documents, not one-size-fits-all. And a really good one is a lot of pages. Different states have different execution formalities. Here we always try to do execution formalities that will pass muster in every state. For example, if you're in Florida and you're executing a power of attorney, after I think it's September 2012, but I'm not positive on that. It requires two witnesses and a notary. And it also, after that date is when it's no longer allowed to be a springing power. I've already gone through a lot about the healthcare proxy, which is at number 7. I'm going to come to living wills in a minute. First, I want to talk about HIPAA authorizations. HIPAA authorizations came into being because of federal regulations that were effective April 15, 2003. Those regulations created a lot of civil and criminal penalties for hospitals, doctors, insurance agencies that communicate medical information about you without authority. The regulations have built into them all kinds of exceptions so that the medical industry didn't come to a screeching halt all of a sudden. But it also requires a lot of authorizations. Most of those authorizations, I'm going to actually be more careful here. Most of that authority is given in what's called HIPAA consent. And those are the things where a doctor or hospital gives you a form. It's probably, one page printed on both sides and you sign it. That HIPAA consent is something that they create, you sign. It gives them the ability to share your medical information with a lab that they need to send your blood samples to or whatever, and also to bill the insurance company and so forth. A HIPAA authorization is different. A HIPAA authorization is something you create, typically with your attorney, and it can be very broad, and it gives various people who you decide that you want medical information to be able to be shared with. It gives all doctors, all hospitals, and so forth the ability to share that information without fear of being sued, without fear of criminal penalty. Now, it's merely an authorization. It's not a requirement that the doctor talk to whoever you name, but the medical profession effectively treats it that way, so that with a HIPAA authorization, generally speaking, the people that you love, the people that you trust, will be able to talk to the doctors, will be able to get medical records, and so on. What's really nice about this is that it doesn't require you, unlike a healthcare proxy, it doesn't require you to be incompetent. So this is a very, it's turned out, at first it looked to us all like it was going to be nothing but another pain, but it turned out to be a really useful tool in our arsenal for estate planning. Everybody ought to have some kind of a HIPAA authorization in addition to a healthcare proxy.
All right, I think I'm doing all right on time. Advanced directives. Advanced directives. I'm going to come back to that because I want Annette to chime in on that. I'm going to talk about appointments, skipping to number 10 just temporarily. The last thing about an incapacity document is this. Historically, you could nominate to the court who you would like to be guardian or conservator of your minor child in your will. And that was it. If you died, you could say, well, court, here's who I nominate, because only the court can appoint the guardian. Here's who I nominate to be the guardian of my minor child or minor children. That became expanded to include, under state statutes, that the parents had the first-in-line priority to nominate guardians and conservators for incapacitated adult children. Excuse me. Because under the laws of most states, a person themselves, an adult themselves, has the first priority. In many states, including Massachusetts, you exercise that authority in your own durable power of attorney to nominate who you want your guardian and your conservator to be. But if your child has been incapacitated, has a significant intellectual disability since birth, let's say, they may never have had a chance as an adult to create their own durable power of attorney, create their own healthcare proxies. So, you, the parents of that, say, intellectually disabled child, you have the next priority in many states. You can nominate who you would want to be the guardian or conservator. But again, it was by will when you died. A number of states, including Massachusetts, now have the ability where you can create a document, a separate document. It's not your will, because the will is only effective when you die. Create a separate standalone document where you can nominate the guardians and conservators for your adult disabled children if you become incapacitated. So that's a very powerful new tool in some states. I want to go now to advanced directives, and then I'll be turning things over to Annette, but not just for her part of the program, but rather I also want her to chime in on the advanced directives.
Mark?
Also, yeah.
I wanted to make a point about the nomination form. So we will often get folks, and I think this is particularly something that can occur in the Mito community, where somebody will become disabled as an adult. Maybe the Mito has come on in their 30s or 40s, or maybe they've had it, but it's just taken a serious turn as somebody's older. Parents can still have a nomination form for that adult child. It doesn't need to be a disabled child, you know, somebody who was disabled in their childhood. And that's a common question that comes up a lot, especially in the community where people are having more healthcare issues than they are intellectual disability issues.
Right. That's very good. And just to add in, onto that. So if the person, as Annette has described, they were competent for a good chunk of their adulthood, or even a small part, if they had already made their own nominations of guardian conservators by executing a durable power of attorney, typically that exercised that ability, that would take priority over a parent's nomination. If they had never done that, then the parent's nomination would take a priority. If we were talking about on the parent's incapacity, if the parent were the guardian, let's say, but only if it was a state that had enacted a statute that permitted that.
Let me give you an example of how that
would
work. So we had a client who, had Mito, and it got serious as they got older. They had never done their own estate planning. They were an adult, and had a serious situation where they had a stroke and were unable now to execute their own documents. So parents who were still living and competent were able to step in and do some planning for that adult, now disabled child. So that's a situation where that might be very helpful, just to kind of give a picture to what that situation might look like.
All right, so the last bit that I want to talk about, and I've only got about 2 minutes left, is advanced directives. People ask a lot of questions about advanced directives, and I think that the emphasis on advanced directives in the public's mind is much higher than it is in the minds of most estate planning lawyers. Living wills is probably the most predominant in most people's minds, maybe. Living wills exist by statute in 47 states, not in Massachusetts, not in New York, and not in, I believe, Michigan. Ah, yes, I see my list. I got it right. That might sound horrifying, but really living wills predate healthcare proxies by a long shot. Living wills cover a very narrow set of circumstances, a very narrow end-of-life set of circumstances. In my view, I've seen a lot of them. They are often drafted rather sloppily. If you really parse through what they're saying, sometimes if you read them right, realize that they say, kill me if I have a hangnail, which is not what most people intend. Really, the dominant thing you need is a healthcare proxy. And you need to talk with your agent or agents, successor agents, about what you have in mind. Living wills, I think, can be useful if they are expressed as guidance for the healthcare agent, in the sense that it can, I think, sometimes help, say, a child make a difficult decision and still be able to live with the decision later. But in general, I don't think that they're essential, even in states with living will statutes. Even in states without living will statutes, a living will, like in Massachusetts, is valid. It is a valid expression, and it is a constitutionally protected expression. But it's not self-executing, as it is in the 47 states. In the 47 states that have these statutes, if you say, under these circumstances, I direct my medical professionals to, you know, let's just say colloquially, pull the plug, then the hospital can do that. In Massachusetts, they would go to court to get an order to do that if you did not have a healthcare agent to do it. Now, a lot of these other things, these are things like five wishes, the Harvard grid, and so forth, are extraordinarily intricate, detailed sets of lots and lots of circumstances, and what if this, and what if that, and what would you want? I find them just ludicrous. I don't see how anybody can make any sense of them. I don't see how anybody can predict what they would want. Then there's a category of things which are actually truly directives to medical professionals, DNRs and MOLS, and that, could you talk about those?
Yeah, so medical orders for life-sustaining treatment are available in most states, and they just, you know, it's going to be very state-specific, and DNRs are available in every state on some level. And both of them require a doctor to work with the patient to decide what those medical orders look like. And they're an expression of wishes, but they tend to be more medical in nature. So they're going to have more medical terminology and more medical language. And supposedly, the doctor is supposed to be able to walk you through filling these out so that you are giving thought to all of these various circumstances that may happen. I think, in my experience of almost 20 years of working with many, many very sick people, both children and adults, all stages of life, the doctor's orders do work best. but they are still just an expression of your wishes. And the absolute best thing that you can do for yourself is to pick a healthcare agent who can really talk to you about your wishes and will be fluid with you through all the changes in your wishes and throughout your healthcare treatment plan, et cetera, et cetera. The reason that I say that is because things change so quickly, it's hard to really predict how you're going to feel from one moment to the next. And, you know, I don't know if anybody saw that movie about, that was called Still Alice. If you have, you know what I'm talking about. It's about a person who got to a point in her dementia where she had forgotten what her wishes were for herself, and wasn't able to actually execute on them any longer, but she hadn't really shared them with her family and with the people who were, you know, there to make decisions for her and with her. So I think that picking a healthcare agent and having good communication with that healthcare agent is the most important thing that you can do to ensure that the decisions get made the way that you would want them to when you're not able to make them for yourself. Now, I understand that not everybody has that luxury. Not everybody has that trusted person or people in their life. And not all of our trusted people in our life have the ability to make decisions that we would want them to rather than what they would want. So those are times when those medical orders can be essential so that you've got a club, if you will, to be sure that your wishes get followed. If you need somehow to pursue that in court, or if your medical practitioner needs to pursue that in court. So that's kind of all I want to say about that. I'm sure people will have lots of questions, but practical advice is to really just focus on picking great healthcare agents and on making sure that you have good communication with those agents.
And so that, I guess, just to end this bit, I think, you know, to use one of your favorite words, right, you're looking for somebody who can be a good advocate for you.
Right.
And, you know, I believe I heard somebody, you know, before we began, you know, talking about, maybe I'm sorry, but talking about how medical professionals, despite what she wants, will order something different or you know, the medical professionals aren't sometimes, it seems, working with you. And none of these documents are really going to change any of that. So if they're fighting you, they're going to fight your healthcare agent too. And also, I guess the last bit is the proper context, I think, of the DNRs and the MOLTs. You know, if you're, you know, 50 years old and in good health or something like that, you know, that's one thing. I think, you know, sure, maybe a living will is fine. But I think the DNRs and the MOLTs, I think they're mostly, I think, useful for people who have a known, you know, really significant medical condition, and they're looking ahead and saying, if I get into such and such kind of trouble, and knowing my medical condition and so forth, this is what I want or what I don't want. And that, am I reading that right, or is that not?
Yeah. No, that's okay. Right. So I think that we're going to switch gears now and talk about when planning, advanced planning, is not possible, then we have to think about how else can we get that legal authority to have somebody make decisions for us. And in my practice, often we're talking about parents who are trying to get legal authority to continue making decisions as their kids become legal adults at age 18. My first slide has the title Transition Planning, because legal authority is one of the three main pillars of legal transition planning for youth with disabilities as they become adults with disabilities. And, you know, we've talked... Yes?
I'm sorry, if I could just interrupt you right here just for 1 minute to just make sure everyone knows where the slides are.
Absolutely.
If you're just joining us and go to the main letter action page, under most recent news, there is a link to the incapacity planning and guardianship blog post, and that has in the join us box a link that says view the slides. And that is going to be where the slides are. So sorry for the interruption there, and that I just want to make sure everyone knew where to go.
No problem. It gave me a chance to sip some more water. I'm sorry, everybody. I have a little bit of laryngitis today. I hope you can hear me okay and I'm not too scratchy.
You're sounding great.
Okay, good. So the reason, again, that this first slide is titled Transition Planning is because legal authority is one of the main focuses of transitioning a youth with disabilities to an adult with disabilities. And we have to talk about whether that youth is going to be able to make their own legal decisions at age 18, whether they're going to be able to execute any of those incapacity documents so that they can have parents or other caregivers assist with their decision making. And if not, then we need to think about guardianship so that somebody has the legal authority to make healthcare and potentially financial decisions for this person as they become their a legal adult and their own legal person at age 18. So why should we consider guardianship? Mark talks quite a bit about when guardianship would be necessary if you have an adult who's become disabled as an adult. So I'm not going to go into that with too much detail and really going to be focused on thinking about whether guardianship is appropriate as your disabled youth or your mito youth is aging and becoming a legal adult. In my practice, one of the main reasons that we consider guardianship, even if we have somebody who does not have a particular intellectual disability and who could make some day-to-day decisions for themselves, like so many of our mito kids can, we do want to still consider the guardianship because of that advocacy piece. I can't be too strong about that. Our 18 to 25-year-old population, and even a little bit younger, say 16 to 25-year-olds, we're trying to make sure that their life gets set up with all of the support and services that they need to be able to live as full a life as possible. And that is so complex. It's complex even for parents. We are often struggling so much with trying to find the right program, the right public benefits, the right financial resources, the right people resources. It's very hard to think about a child turning 18 who may have capacity to figure out what they want to wear, what friends to have, you know, can manage through their educational services, but probably would have difficulty hiring a caregiver, a PCA. So, you know, they may need assistance with being able to manage some of those higher functions or those higher decisions that our mito kids are unfortunately saddled with because of their illness, because of their disability. So by virtue of the fact that our kids are dealing with a lot more than the typical 18-year-old, it may make guardianship more necessary, rather than less necessary. So another example of that, I've spent some time on this on podcast as well, is dealing with the school system. In many states, you're going to have education or transition services continue past age 18. In Massachusetts, it's very common for kids to be going to school or some educational funded transition program until age 22. But there's often a struggle to be sure that those services are provided in a climate where dollars are scarce and programs are scarce. Parents are very fiercely advocating for the right services and supports and financial supports for their kids. An 18-year-old who's got, you know, other issues going on because of their illness and disability is probably not going to be able to self-advocate to the level that parents would be able to. And again, that's why guardianship may be necessary. We want to also mention that in many states, guardianship is not an all or nothing thing. We can have some form of limited guardianship. There can be limitations on the guardianship so that to whatever extent the young adult can make decisions for themselves, those decisions can be carved out and left to them. The mechanism, how that happens, is a little different from state to state, but all states have moved forward and are considerate of the idea that not all decision-making needs to be left to a guardian, that we want to honor self-determination and independence wherever we can. That is something that we have done a great job of moving towards, and frankly, Massachusetts has been one of the last states to the party on that issue. What is a guardianship? Well, just like some of the other documents that we were talking about, guardianship is where legal authority has been given to an individual to make certain and specific decisions for an incapacitated adult. And again, an adult is somebody 18 years of age or older. But only a court of law or a judge, if you will, can determine whether somebody is incapacitated and to what extent they are incapacitated. So, for example, they can't make healthcare decisions, but they can make financial decisions. Whether a guardian should be named. So maybe somebody has an incapacity, but a guardian, you know, should not be named for whatever reason. I've never seen that, but it could happen. But most importantly, the court does get to determine who should be named as guardian. This is where all the planning, the prior planning comes into place, and this is where those important nomination forms have really front and center spot in your life, because if you're able to, for yourself, name in your healthcare proxies and your powers of attorney who you would nominate to take care of those things for you if you were unable to do them for yourself, and as a parent, if you're also able to use those documents to nominate who you would like next to step in for your children if you can't do it for them, that is going to take precedence over a court-appointed somebody off of a list or somebody that the judge knows. The judge always has the right to reject who's been nominated, but they have to have good reason. They can't just say, well, you know, this guy that I play golf with, you know, I just really want to make sure he has a lot of business this year, so I'm going to send him all the cases I have. They have to have a good reason. As Mark mentioned, one of those reasons could be that somebody has criminal charges against them, or there's been some abuse in the family, or, you know, for whatever reason, the court has determined that they wouldn't make a good guardian or conservator. So the counseling that we do here, as kids are starting to approach 18, as we're sitting with their family, you know, people really are concerned about pursuing guardianship because they're so sensitive to the idea that they don't want to take away rights or take away somebody's independence. We spend 18 years building our kids up and really just celebrating every achievement and pushing them forward and pushing them forward and wanting them to achieve. And then we get to this, you know, 17 and a half, 18 years old, and all of a sudden we're scared because we realize, well, our child is doing great, but they're not ready to face the big bad world. You know, there's too many things that can happen. On the pro side of doing guardianship, being able to continue to advocate, there's no other great legal way to be able to continue to advocate. A power of attorney is just not going to do it. If you recall, powers of attorney and health care proxies are not only are they easily revocable, but they're also questioned often, especially the powers of attorney, and their concurrent authority, at least for the powers of attorney, are other agency documents. And that means that our children can make a decision that vetoes the decision that we would make for them. So let me give you an example of what that would look like. In our state, and in many states, we have in our school systems, as part of our IEP process, when a student turns 18, if they are still in school, they can sign a form called a shared decision-making form. That gives their parents the ability to continue attending IEP meetings and sharing information and assisting in decision-making. But it does not give parents the right to overrule the student. The student still has all the full rights of decision-making. And in our state, there have been examples, and they're not that isolated, of examples where school districts have pushed graduation and pushed diplomas on students so that they could stop providing services for children who were kind of borderline, but really could have used a couple more years of transition services to get out there, be working an independent living. And so this is, again, it's not isolated as an incident. It happens more often than we'd like to think. The school districts are facing humongous budget crises and more students than they can really manage given the money that they have. So although I don't think there's that intent there, there can be this push or pull to really try to graduate as many students as possible. So that's one example where a shared decision-making form, if a student decides to be graduated like the rest of their friends, would really not work well because it would overrule a parental decision to keep fighting for more support. And that's where a legal guardianship could be very helpful. Now, on the negative side of guardianship, it can be expensive and complicated. It's a court process, and that means that most of the documents are going to be public documents. Your medical documents are not going to be public documents. They're going to be called impounded documents, and only parties to the case can get them. But all the other documents, like the petition to start the guardianship, they still have information on there about people's disabilities. In addition, depending on whether you are going to hire an attorney or not, the cost can be prohibitive. And depending on the state you're in, the guardianship has some oversight with the court. Conservatorship, so that means that the court is involved in your life, and to some extent, you have some reporting authority or requirements so that the court knows what's going on with this person with a disability. Back in the day, before we reformed our guardianship rules, somebody would go under guardianship and then they would never be heard from again. And, we've had some really horrible incidences over the last 50 years of disabled folks who were taken advantage of or who nobody was looking in at or not really understanding whether the guardian was doing a good job. Now, it's important to note that in all states, the guardian is required to take into consideration what the person under guardianship would want if they were able to make decisions for themselves. So the guardian is not making decisions in a vacuum. They still need to consult with and consider what that person would want. And that's something that often gets forgotten when you're talking about a parent and child dynamic. It can be hard to move into a guardian and ward dynamic from a parent and child dynamic. It's something that people need to work on gradually. So in our case, I really feel pretty strongly that when it comes to youth, the alternatives are not that useful, at least not yet. But one thing that I wanted to mention is that in our state and in some other states, we've been exploring something called shared decision-making or supported decision-making. And that's a way to avoid guardianship for some folks who maybe don't have a trusted person who can be their guardian, but there's a way to have decisions be supported, but still have some oversight. Not court oversight, but there's agencies involved that have some authority to do some oversight of the person's life and the decisions that are happening. So that's something kind of exciting and new that's happening. We're always changing and trying to move into a better future for people with disabilities. And I think with that, I'm going to close so that we have time to take some questions.
Well, thank you so much, Annette and Mark. This has been some really useful and helpful information. I think if you all have time to stay for a few questions from our participants today.
Absolutely.
Wonderful. Well, I've got one question that has come in through email that I'll go ahead and ask before I open up the phone lines. And I want to remind everybody who's listening that if you have a question and don't feel like asking it over the phone or have a lot of background noise, feel free to email me at outreach@mitoaction.org, and I would be happy to ask the question on your behalf. So I do have one that came in, and this is from a parent in California who has a 16-year-old son with mito and autism. And she has a question about if California has transitioned from a guardianship model to a conservancy model. Now, I know this is a very state-specific question, but I'm not sure if this is something you can comment on. So she wants to know what's the difference between guardianship and conservancy, and then she has a follow-up question as well.
So really, there's no difference. It's just a different name. You know, we used to be a guardianship of the person, guardianship of the estate, and we've moved to guardianship, which is all personal decision-making, and conservatorship, which is all financial. And so it's really, there's no difference. It's the authority granted in the judge's order is what's going to prevail, not so much the name.
Okay, that's very helpful. Thank you. And the follow-up question that she has is her child is 16, and she would like to know if she can complete conservancy before the actual 18th birthday in order to avoid any gaps.
I'm not sure about California, but in most states, that's a no. You can start doing all of the paperwork, and depending on how fast or slow your state is, like in Massachusetts, it can take anywhere from 3 to 6 months to do all of the steps that you need to do. It's very paperwork heavy. There's evidence of disability that you need to provide. There needs to be a hearing. Everybody needs to be given notice of that hearing, and so you have to follow certain steps to get there. But you can do everything, and then you can get a hearing as close to the birthday as possible. The gaps are not something to necessarily worry about. In most states, folks know that you're in process and are willing to accept and continue to allow you to decision make. So, for example, we'll have our parents, give a docket number for the case in the court, and we'll let schools know and we'll let doctors know that, our hearing birthday's on, the 1st, and our hearing's on the 15th, and, we're not going to have much of a gap, and they're definitely continue to accept parents' authority to make decisions or at least participate in the decision making for a while. When it comes to emergencies, there's a natural decision process that will happen in the hospital if there's an emergency, where they'll go to the next of kin regardless. So if you were an adult and you had an accident, they're going to naturally call your spouse, your children, you know, whoever your next of kin are, to help decision make over any emergency medical decisions. So I try to let our parents know not to worry too much about that. It's good to get started about 6 months before that 18th birthday, but I have many families who don't even come to see me until their child's already 18 or 19 years old, and it's not too late then. We can still get working on things.
That is great to know. Really good information. One last question from this mom is, she just wanted to understand how judges and courtrooms deal with nonverbal kids and behaviors that might be disruptive. Any thoughts on that?
Oh, that's such a great question. So most of the time, the kids don't need to be there. And it will depend on your state. In some states, the kids are going to have an attorney appointed for them, and the attorney is going to appear on their behalf. In other states, you're going to have something called a guardian ad litem, who's like a court investigator that goes out and meets with the family and the kid and will report back to the court. But in most cases that I'm aware of, the court will waive the appearance if all notice has been given properly, so that the person has the opportunity to appear if they would want to. On the other hand, the person has the right to be there. I've had only a couple of instances where I've had young folks who wanted to be there, and sometimes I ask for a closed courtroom, or we let the clerks know of the situation. Our judges are very kind here. I'm sure that's the case in most states. So we might, for example, have a case at the 2 o'clock session, and they'll take us first at 2 o'clock so that we can get in and out really quickly. If we've got somebody who's completely nonverbal, you know, the judge will look and see if there's a way to communicate with that person, whatever the typical communication is. But more often than that, we have folks who are a little bit disruptive. Our folks with autism are so much fun sometimes. You know, we have lots of things that get said in the courtroom, and that, you know, that can be fun. And the judges are very understanding about that as well. But they will try. A busy docket day here in Massachusetts could be 60 cases. So they'll try to close the courtroom or to schedule something in a way that we can get the family in and out quickly. But for the most part, just to kind of go back to what I said at the beginning, we're going to try to avoid having that person come into court if at all possible.
Okay, terrific. Well, that is incredibly helpful. Thank you so much. And now I'm going to go ahead and open up the lines. So if you have any questions, I want to encourage you to ask them, but also want to mention that we are recording this conversation. And so anything that you do ask, please try to keep it general, as general as possible, and do not include too many personal details, as we will be archiving this in iTunes. So you'll hear a series of beeps as I go ahead and unmute the lines.
The conference is now in talk mode.
Okay, so we should be all set for taking questions. Who would like to go first? Does anyone have any questions?
This is Irina Campbell. I'm just about to send an email to Christine because at the beginning of this session today, she mentioned that she would need to talk to me individually, so I just sent her an email now with my telephone number, and I would really appreciate having some assistance.
Terrific. I did get that, Irina, and we can definitely talk offline, but do you have any questions that you might want to ask of Mark or Annette?
Well, I'm sure that other patients also who have mitochondrial disease have a list of contraindicated medications. Among them, for me, are the antipsychotic medications. And I have special diet restrictions. I have tried to investigate a little on my behalf with, for example, senior residences, I've been told by one of them, I don't know if this is correct information, that if I were to transition in their facility from independent living and able to take my own medications myself into assisted living, that they would refuse to give me my vitamin cocktail, my Mardo cocktail, because the vitamins in the United States are not approved by the Food and Drug Administration. So they said to me, I would have to pay approximately extraordinarily expensive cost of assisted living in a senior residence. I would have to pay an outside person to come 4 times a day to give me my vitamins for my Mardo cocktail. I had put in
I have a suggestion. This is Annette. I think that Mark and I might be able to get on the phone with you and Christine at some later date.
I don't know if I was being correctly informed.
Yeah, so I think it would be great if we could maybe get some more details from you at a later date, and Christine can set up a call with us, and we'll be happy to talk to you offline about maybe getting you some resources in your area. And
I've struggled here for the last 10 years with resources in my area.
Well, and we'll see what we can do.
I really need some help with this.
Irina, let's definitely take this offline, and Annette and Mark, thank you so much for the offer to speak with us. I think a call with all four of us will be really helpful, so let's go ahead and do that. But
I really appreciate that.
Yeah, no, we'd be happy to do that, and thank you, Annette, for that.
Sure.
And I do have actually a question that just came in about guardianship, and basically the question boils down to this. What do you do if you don't have anyone obvious to serve as an agent or guardian?
So that's a great question. It does come up a lot for adults. Sometimes people don't want their family members making decisions for them, or they just don't have anybody available really that can do it. And there are a number of nonprofit agencies in every state that do take this on. The National Guardianship Association is a really good resource, and they can help point you in the right direction in your state if you go to their website. They may be able to point you to organizations, nonprofit organizations that do provide guardianship services. Usually the services are at a fairly nominal fee, you know, not tons of money. To help make personal decisions. This is not the case with assets. If you have money, it's a different process and kind of a different setup that you're going to want to have. But if you really need a guardian to help make personal decisions for you as you decline, then I would suggest starting with the National Guardianship Association or your local state chapter of that guardianship association and seeing if they can provide some resources and support for you.
Well, that is a terrific resource, and we'll go ahead and add that to our website as well, because I think that would be very helpful for a number of folks. I had one other question come in, actually. There are a number of online legal document preparation services, and this is something that Mark had mentioned in his talk, that if you have just a one-page power of attorney document, that that's probably not going to be sufficient. Would either of you be able to comment on those online preparation services, when they work, when they don't, and what the pitfalls are that you can run into when you do use something that you got off the web?
Hey, Mark, do you want me to take this one, or do you want to take this one?
No, you get going, and then I'll probably get mad and chime in.
So we're always at the risk of sounding like we're trying to drum up business for ourselves, right? But I have to say that if you have something serious going on with you, like Mito, you should really not be filling out forms from a website or from a document production, you know, service. It's not going to be tailored to you, and it's not going to take into consideration all of the decision-making that you need to do. In general, we don't like them because they do tend to be just one-size-fits-all. Estate planning is called planning for a reason. It's not called estate document production. The biggest part of what you're paying for when you seek counsel of an attorney is the planning process, somebody to counsel you. People have lots of questions, and you deserve to have those questions answered. That's where your money is best spent. And attorneys range, such a wide range of costs, and just because somebody is higher priced or lower priced doesn't mean they're better or worse than, you know, somebody else. So it's one of those things that's really hard to gauge, you know, how your, where your, the value, I guess, of the services that you're receiving and the money that you're paying for them. But in general, I know Mark is going to be much more stern about this than I am. In general, I think for people with Mito, using document production services is probably not a great idea.
Yep, that makes a lot of sense. And Mark, do you want to comment on that at all?
Oh, you know, look, we wouldn't have the jobs that we do if we could be replicated by LegalZoom. The thing is that you know, with any plan, if there are no problems, then there were no problems with the plan. But you don't know that until it's a little late. What you're really paying for is somebody who's been around the block and knows what they're doing. This is a field that it could keep me busy beyond 24/7 trying to keep up with all that we have to know. And you really need somebody in your corner. You just do.
That makes a lot of sense. And
oh, and when things do go wrong, by the way, half the time people don't know that there could have been a better outcome. And if they do know that there could have been a better outcome, try suing LegalZoom. You'll get nowhere because they owe you nothing and not your lawyer.
That's an excellent point. So how do you go about finding an attorney to handle the preparation of these documents?
Wow. Well, you definitely want to try to look to whatever state bar organizations have some kind of specialty. So at the very least, you want to get somebody who's an estate planner, not a generalist. Again, I'm really talking to the Mito community. You know, we're people who have more complicated lives and more complicated issues for estate planning than the average person does. So we need to make sure we have somebody who's at least one, qualified in estate planning, but two, particularly qualified in the areas of disability, special needs, or elder law. The National Academy of Elder Law Attorneys has a great website, and they have attorneys in every state that practice in this area of law, some better than others. You want to look at designations like Mark has, which is certified elder law attorney. That means that he has to meet a higher bar to be able to get that designation that is a nationally recognized designation. You want to look at things like super lawyers, which is a peer nomination. It's not something that you can buy. You can't just, you know, join a club and slap some label after your name. You want to look for people who have advanced degrees besides their law degree. So, like, I have an MBA. Mark has an LLM, which is a Master's of Laws in tax. So there are different qualifications, but when you actually go to interview the attorney, that's where the rubber meets the road. You want to have good rapport with that person. Do they take time? Do they answer your questions? Are they patient with you if you are the person with a disability? Many of our folks are really smart people, good technical folks, but they don't understand how to work with people who are sick. You know, they get frustrated when clients have to cancel on them because things come up and they're in the hospital or they're not feeling well today. You know, things like that. So you want to make sure you have good rapport. You want to make sure your questions are being answered. You want to make sure that this is the person that you would feel comfortable calling year after year to help you. You want to understand how you're getting billed for the services. Is it going to be a flat fee? What's included in that fee? Is it going to be hourly? After you meet a certain threshold, is it going to be hourly after that? You know, do they bill for every phone call, every email? Are you going to see the person who you're calling? You know, I have people who call here and say, Annette, I think you're awesome and we really want to work with you, but I want to make sure that when I hire you, I'm not going to get relegated to your two-year associate, you know, who's going to be the one I talk to all the time. So those are the kinds of things that you need to check in about and be smart about before you engage somebody to do this work.
I just wanted to jump in on a couple of things there. So, and that started off with talking about credentials and things. And I'm kind of a credential junkie. You know, I have an ego that's ridiculous, and I love collecting letters after my name, things that only my mother cares about, you know. But the truth is, none of that means anything. What really matters, I think, is a lot of the of non-credential things that Annette was talking about. But in particular, and you know, it's hard to determine on the face of it, because I mean, anybody can tell you any answer that they think you want to hear. But if you're talking about somebody, if the particular case you're talking about is somebody with an adult onset disability, but, you know, not elderly, under 65, that presents one set of circumstances that's tough to deal with. Tougher to deal with for an elder law, for an attorney than, you know, a strictly elder law situation, in my view. Not somebody who does that a lot, who is skilled at those things, who does a lot of work with, you know, keeping adult onset disability people in the community and helping them live the best lives that they can. If we're talking about a person who has had significant disabilities since birth or since a very young age, you want to talk to somebody who really specializes, who does a lot of their cases in helping kids like that. So, yeah, you want to, like I said, it's tough to ferret that out. You say, you know, do you handle these cases? Do you handle a lot of these cases? I guess anybody could just lie through their teeth and say yes. But if you ask enough questions, you can kind of get if they really get it, if they've really been practicing in that community, you know? And I don't know if you can flesh that out at all, if you can express better what I'm saying.
No, I think that was really good.
Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense. There's, you know, you have to look at both the credentials and the intangibles and the experience, right?
Right.
That's really helpful. Well, we're running a little short on time here, but I wanted to just check in and see if there's anybody else on the call who might want to ask a question before we wrap up. Okay, well, it sounds like we're good to go. And Annette and Mark, I want to thank you both so very much for this amazing information. It's really, really helpful to have this all laid out and have it tailored so well to the MITO community as well. So thank you both so much for all of your time today and for sharing all this important information with us. If folks would like to reach you, I did post your website on our blog page, but it's specialneeds-law.com, is that right?
Right, exactly.
Terrific. Well, again, thank you both so very much, and we really appreciate all that you do.
Thank you, Christine. It's always a pleasure to be here and be part of MITO, you know, near and dear to my heart, so I'm always happy to participate in whatever way I can.
Oh, wonderful. It means so much to our community, so thank you.
Well, we'll see you in a couple of weeks when we're talking about school stuff.
That's right. All right, until next time then.
Okay. Thank you, everybody.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Beep. 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 Beep.